Welcome to the Arbitration Conversation with Amy Schmitz.
Hello, and welcome to the Arbitration Conversation. So in this Arbitration Conversation, I'm very excited. We have a professor, a scholar, an arbitrator from to the north, Canada, and really a very kind person as well, who I got to spend time with at Ohio State University, where she also taught commercial arbitration. So with us today as our guest is Professor Tamar Michel. Professor Michel is an associate professor and CN professor of international trade. She holds a JD degree from the University of British Columbia and a BA with honors, an LLM and SJD degree from University of Toronto. Tamar practiced international commercial arbitration in a law firm in Vancouver as deputy counsel at the International Court of Arbitration of the International Chamber of Commerce in Paris, and as a legal advisor to the Jerusalem Arbitration Center in Israel and Palestine. She was also a research fellow with the Max Planck Institute for Procedural Law in Luxembourg, which incidentally, I was also in Luxembourg as a researcher for a stint, so that was a nice connection, and a scholar in residence with WilmerHale's International Arbitration Group in London, a visiting scholar in Edinburgh, in Scotland, and also lecture, like I said, at The Ohio State, Moritz College of Law. And I had the pleasure of meeting Professor Michel and getting a chance to talk with her. So first of all, just a delight to have you with us, Tamar, and I just want to thank you for taking time to talk about arbitration with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, what I really want to talk about, there's so many things I could ask you about, because you really do have a long, really cool history in arbitration, international arbitration. And so the first question I have for you, you are a true international scholar in arbitration, you teach international commercial arbitration, but yet you have this new article that focuses on American arbitration law under the Federal Arbitration Act. So first of all, I just want to understand, and you and I did get a chance to talk a bit about this, but now if you could share with the listeners, what drew you to the Federal Arbitration Act under U.S. law when you have all this background in international arbitration?
Yeah, definitely. So I am Canadian, and most of my work originally in the arbitration world was international commercial arbitration mostly. It's a funny story because, and I'll be short about it, a couple of years ago in 2019, and I was happily researching international arbitration, and I got an email from a lawyer in the US somewhere who was working on an amicus brief for the GE case that was at the time pending before the Supreme Court in the United States. And he asked me just for access to one of my older articles that was out there, talking about, or in which I wrote about, the same or a very similar issue of non-signatories that was before the Supreme Court in the United States in a completely different case in the UK, some international case. And he just wanted access to it. And then, but I got curious. And I was like, what is this GE case? Because it was an international arbitration case pending before the Supreme Court. And that became a ginormous rabbit hole that I just started to go through. And then I found the FA, once I got kind of familiar with the American arbitration system and, you know, chapter one, chapter two of the FAA, and I just got completely fascinated with the Federal Arbitration Act. And it's just, it's a fascinating statute. It's just the gift that keeps on giving if you're a researcher, because it's 100 years old. It's very, you know, it's very skeletal. There are plenty of issues that, you know, still arise out of it, interpretive issues. Supreme Court takes a case now, one or two FAA cases every single year, which I find amazing. And it's just arbitration in the United States has become such a fascinating topic that is very controversial. Far more controversial than in Canada, for instance. So it's interesting, like, to think about it comparatively, and far more controversial than you would just think that a topic like an alternative dispute resolution method that's contractual and consensual would ever be. And so it's just fascinating to me. And so that's kind of how I got into it. And now that I've written quite a few articles about the FAA and American arbitration law, and there are really synergies with international, because really you can, I don't, I'm of the opinion that you cannot really practice international commercial arbitration as it pertains to the United States, whether it's the seat or whether you're enforcing an award, the international award in the United States courts, without understanding the FAA, because Chapter 1, which is the domestic chapter, applies unless it's contradictory to Chapter 2 or the New York Convention. So the average practitioner who does international commercial arbitration pertaining to the United States has to have an understanding, basic even, of Chapter 1 and how the courts deal with domestic arbitration in the United States. Yeah. So that's kind of my goal is kind of to do these synergies and comparisons. And this latest article really delves into how the courts treat domestic, mostly, I will say. But again, everything has an impact on international arbitration. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it makes sense. I mean, if you talk about rabbit holes, which I fully appreciate because I do that quite a bit with my own research. And I remember back in 1999, and I was researching the history of the Federal Arbitration Act, and I was diving deeply into everything. And I was looking at ancient Egyptian arbitration and just how old and really arbitration predates litigation. Mm. And then when you think about the Federal Arbitration Act and the New York Convention, indeed, the New York Convention is fashioned after the FAA. But what is so interesting about the Federal Arbitration Act is the jurisprudence around it. You're right. Our courts do tend to be very active in shaping the law, especially because the Federal Arbitration Act itself is quite short and very skeletal, as you said. And I love that you kind of get into your research. You have a recent article, The Gatekeepers of the Federal Arbitration Act, an Empirical Analysis of the FAA in the Lower Courts. And you're right, so much happens in the lower courts. We tend to focus on the Supreme Court and what does the Supreme Court say about the Federal Arbitration Act. But most of the bread and butter, most of what's really happening in the daily practice is in the lower courts. So maybe you want to share a little bit about this research, kind of when it started and the evolution, because that's the other really interesting story here, I think, because I saw earlier iterations. I remember the first draft prior to your presentation at Ohio State, then you had a new draft at that point, and now you have yet another draft. So maybe you want to start with, kind of the evolution.
Sure. Yeah, it's the life cycle of a major article, yeah. Right? So this started, the idea to do this started as I was investigating and making my way through the jurisprudence about the FAA. And I started like everybody else with Supreme Court decisions. But as of today, there are 60. And that's a lot, but it's over 100 years of the life of the statute. It's a lot, but I really felt after reading all of them, I really felt that I still don't have a good grasp really of what's going on, how the law develops. Okay, when it reaches the Supreme Court, that's the final word. But what happens with, and I assumed at the time, far more cases, FAA cases that obviously would go through the lower courts. And it is true that in the scholarship generally, the vast majority of FAA-related articles that I read focus on the Supreme Court, usually in a critical way. That look what the Supreme Court has done to the Federal Arbitration Act, and that's a different article that I have that I'm not going to looking at that. But that's the main focus has been, and really not many people have looked into. What about all the lower courts? What about the circuits? What about the federal courts? What about the state courts? Because the FAA applies, right, in state courts. And so back during COVID, I decided, okay, I'm gonna start looking into it. And what I did is really starting on June 1st, 2021, I started collecting cases and reading all of them. It's like I did kind of alerts on Westlaw, Lexis. And then I added Bloomberg later in terms of, commercial databases from which to take the cases. And I started collecting them and reading them to see what's the real big picture of how the FAA is dealt with in the lower courts, because there are a lot of presumptions out there and there are a lot of, beliefs that the lower courts, if it wasn't for the Supreme Court's revolution of the FAA, the lower courts would have done things completely differently, right? And so I wanted to see how they do deal with the FAA and how parties with the lawyers. How do they deal with the FAA? And so then I started daily collecting these cases, and it turned out to be a very, very long Excel sheet with many, many cases, thousands. And I did that for a calendar year. So a daily collection of cases for 12 months. And so that was back in 2021, 2022. And then it takes a long time to code everything in order to do a proper empirical analysis. And so I had in total 2,400 cases, give or take, that I read. I decided to focus on the motions to compel arbitration because there were also, of course, motions to enforce awards or set aside awards or things that had to do with evidence or things that had to do just with motions to remand and motions to remove and all stuff like that. But I weeded all those out and focused on the contested motions to compel arbitration. And we ended up with 1,450 of those. Ultimately, there were less when I presented the paper because actually I only added Bloomberg when I was actually at Ohio State. And I added the Bloomberg cases. And so we took those, me and my colleague, I should say, the co-author of the article, Moinyaya, who works with me here at the U of A, and he does the empirical stuff. And so we coded those 1,450 cases, and we tested the outcomes of compelled in part, and denied arbitration. And we coded for all kinds of variables. So we looked at type of courts, level of court, location of court, type of dispute, political association of the judges, arguments. And so do you want just the outcome, what we found?
No, I want to ask a couple of questions about process, sort of backing up a little bit. So first of all, kind of, you know, when you're at Bloomberg and when you're looking at these different, you know, places to find the cases, I assume that you went through and made sure there were no duplications because, you know, you could have the same case pop up in two different places or three different places for that matter.
Right. So, yes. Okay. So we did weed out the duplicates, although if a case went through a bunch of court, the same case, the same parties, right, same dispute, a lower, you know, a district court and then a circuit court of appeal, we did analyze them separately because we're testing what each court would do.
Okay.
Right. And
gotcha.
Sometimes the circuit would reverse.
Right. Right.
Potentially.
Or took that into account as well.
Yeah.
As-
so that in that sense, it's a duplicate because it's the same case, but we're not testing the cases, we're testing the courts. So it made sense to then have that twice because the courts might decide differently.
And then also when you were sort of parsing this out before you get to kind of the findings, another really important kind of question is delegation clauses. So, delegation clauses, of course, are prevalent in most arbitration agreements in the United States. And what that does is that delegates that decision of enforceability to the arbitrator. And so then the court will be more likely to compel arbitration because it will be the arbitrator who will decide whether or not that arbitration clause is enforceable or applicable. So did you code for that as well? Did you look at sort of, okay, these are cases with delegation clauses versus without delegation clauses?
Okay. Yes, I did code for delegation. So I coded for a lot of things that we ultimately did not. So there are also limitations of the actual empirical methodology. You can't test ultimately with these amount of cases. We don't have a million cases. We have a thousand something, which is a lot. But you have to limit the number of variables you're testing. Otherwise, it becomes really not effective. So delegation, I did test, and which we also tested it empirically, didn't really make a difference in the outcomes. But I will say this, that this is one of the perceptions that every single arbitration agreement in the United States would have a delegation clause. What I found, and this is a sample, okay, it's not every single case, but what we found that only 23% of our cases, I cannot say whether they had a delegation clause or not. I can say whether a party raised the delegation argument before the court in the motion to compel. So right. Only 23% of cases raised that argument. And of course, it's relevant for arguments that have to do with or challenges to the arbitration clause that have to do with existence formation, because those are not delegable. But we also tested scope arguments and unconscionability, which are delegable. But again, not the majority of cases with those arguments also had delegation arguments. And the other interesting thing about that is that around 30 to 40%, depending on whether it's scope or unquestionability, in around 30 to 40% of cases, the courts did not delegate to the arbitrator. So it's actually, I think, more cases than most people would think. The court finds that there was no clear and unmistakable intention to delegate, or that the delegation clause itself is invalid for whatever reason, which also allows the court to retain the jurisdiction.
And it might also be self-selection. A couple of things, also kind of getting back to process. Number one, it might be that, if you're an attorney and you see there's a very clear delegation clause, you're probably not going to waste your time in court. You'll go directly to the arbitrator because it wouldn't really be worth the money. So I would imagine that that's part of it. But also, the timing, in terms of COVID and less cases going to courts because courts weren't moving it.
So that's interesting. So on both those points, those are very interesting points, because I would think I would agree that you're right. Why would you go to court if you have a very clear delegation clause? But at the same time, we did see, for instance, and I can talk about that more, about unconscionability arguments. They are losing argument. It is actually shocking how much they are unsuccessful in convincing courts to deny motions to compel arbitration. They are actually positively, significantly related to compelling arbitration, believe it or not. And yet, they're the third out of the four arguments we tested, they're the third most common. So parties still go to court and try the unconscionability route, knowing full well, I believe, that it will be unsuccessful in the vast, vast majority of cases. But they still do it, and they still waste the resources. Why? That's a very good question. And on the second point of there might have been less cases. So I actually continue to this very day to monitor the number of cases. I don't have time to continue to analyze them and code them, unfortunately. But I can tell you the numbers are equivalent. So even after COVID, 2022, 2023, till today, they give or take on average the yearly number of FAA cases that I can access on these databases are roughly the same. So I don't think there was a significant COVID impact that I can tell in any way.
So you say in the paper, in looking at the different variables, the argument was the strongest predictor. So which arguments are most successful?
So the most successful argument is the existence formation argument. So these are arguments that they're the most commonly raised and the most successful. And so these are arguments that there was no anything that has to do with the formation. No consideration, no assent, mutual assent is a very big one, or the very existence. It doesn't exist, right? Or I didn't sign it, and et cetera, et cetera. So these kind of arguments, and I'm sure the fact that they're commonly raised has probably something to do with the fact they're not delegable, as I said, and the court will have to decide. Sure. But the fact that they're most successful is interesting. And I would say worrisome a little bit in terms of, what's happening with how is consent to these arbitration clauses obtained, right? And the more interesting even thing is that they're most successful in the consumer context.
That's what I assumed, actually.
Yeah. And so in our policy recommendations, what we're saying that, if Congress is ever to amend the FAA, well, they did last year, right, or 2 years ago. But if they are ever to amend the first 16 clauses that are the core of Chapter 1, and there are a lot of calls to amend the FAA to exclude entirely employment and consumer dispute. And I say these overall suggestions, let's just take them all out. I would be against something like that. That doesn't distinct. You have to zoom in on what is the issue exactly, or where the problems emanate from. And I think this study shows what policymakers should maybe think about is maybe looking at how consent is obtained in the consumer context in standard form contracts, especially website based online.
I was going to ask you that. My assumption was that the formation questions are generally e-contracts because people don't have any notice or information about it.
So exactly. So you need that reasonable notice, inquiry notice, right? They call it, and it depends if it's the web browse wrap or
yep,
the
or
other
click
type.
wrap.
So it depends on what type it is,
yep.
And the courts have developed quite a substantial body.
Yeah.
Of jurisprudence about
Oh,
this.
I teach contract law, and I spend significant time on click versus browse wrap and the law
Exactly.
around
Yeah.
it. Yeah, and you have cases like Sprecht and very famous cases focusing and arbitration clauses tend to be the main question. You know, is it below the button? Is it above the button? Do you have to read the entire document? You know, all of that matters in terms of consent.
Yeah,
and
the
that
same
means.
Standard should the same standards that are applicable to any online contract should apply to online arbitration contract, right? The Supreme Court said that a million times. It's the same state law contract principles. So that's what they need to do. And but it's a red flag for me. You know, the results indicate this is a red flag, and we need to look into. But this applies to consent to all the terms in that contract. It's not only the arbitration clause. Then you have questions arising as to what are people, are people actually consenting to these entire terms and conditions of the whatever website, right?
Well, and also when you were analyzing the cases, I'm kind of digging a little bit more deeply when you think about this question of formation and consent. Did you have any findings or look at sort of the context also? Because often, you know, for example, in credit card space or particular types of contracts where there's not really a chance, even if you have it and you have to go through the entire thing, it's click wrap, it would be otherwise enforceable. The question is, well, would a consumer actually have an alternative? Would there be another loan or another credit card or a cell phone plan that they could get without an arbitration clause?
So that I found from all the cases I've read, those type of arguments go to unconscionability. They're raised under the umbrella of unconscionability, not formation.
Yes. And they're not successful.
Yeah, and they're usually not successful because most state law unconscionability principles or doctrines require both procedural unconscionability and substantive unconscionability. And that goes to the procedure, right? So would they have, right? Or the substance if the terms are unfair.
But it's not under American arbitration law, though. You're not allowed, basically, the Federal Arbitration Act and the U.S. Supreme Court has spoken.
Right.
That you're not allowed to say, oh, it's unfair simply because it's arbitration.
Exactly.
That doesn't make it unfair. Yeah.
That does not make it unfair. So you have to show some circumstances
yeah.
beyond the mere fact that it's a standard for adhesion contract that contains
right.
an arbitration clause. That's right. And so, and usually those circumstances fail or those arguments fail because the courts have set a quite high, it turns out, standard.
Yeah.
Our threshold to show unconscionability. Generally speaking, this is not specific to arbitration.
And did you only look at federal courts or did you look also at state?
We looked at state courts.
Okay.
There's an important caveat with state courts. They're far more difficult to get your hands on than federal decisions. And so that's why we spread our, you know, we use three databases in an effort
right.
to get as many as we could. With still 60%, we had 60% of our cases were federal. 40%, give or take, were state. And the vast majority of those state cases came out of California because I guess they're reported more
right.
Frequently. But I will say this. So we did test empirically whether or not we got the fact that we had the vast majority of our state cases came out of California, whether that in itself had an impact on the results from the state courts. And we found not really. So there was no California effect in that sense. I will say that's the other kind of surprising, perhaps I shouldn't be surprised, but the California state courts compel arbitration at a higher rate than any other state court that we had represented in our database and higher than the federal courts, federal district courts, believe it or not. And I think a lot of people are going to be surprised by this because you know, right or wrong, California courts and the legislature in California have a reputation for being pro-employment, pro-consumer rights, a kind of anti or suspicious of arbitration. Let's put it like this. The Ninth Circuit is the circuit that's been overturned the most in FAA cases by the Supreme Court. So there's that image of California, whether it's right or wrong. I don't know, because our data indicates it's wrong, because they are actually the state trial courts in particular, not so much the Court of Appeal, the Courts of Appeal of California, but the state trial courts, the vast majority of cases, like over 80%, they compel arbitration. But then you look and you see the kind of argument, the kind of dispute sometimes, not all of them, some of them are meritorious. And again, 30% of cases are denied. The motion to compel is denied. So it's not the case that 100% of motions to compel across the country are granted. So we have to keep that in mind, that they do act as gatekeepers. And when there is a good reason to deny, they deny. But, you know, there was a case, for instance, out of the California courts where the party, the plaintiff sued in court in the context of a real estate transaction. But the subject matter of the lawsuit or their claim was that they wanted damages because the real estate agent, when they were showing the house or whatever, did not provide the lunch that was promised. And that's what they're suing for. And then you got to ask yourself, does this kind of dispute belong in the public court system paid by the taxpayers' money? Is this going to develop the law? Because, you know, one of their arguments against arbitration is you're stifling the development of the common law in the courts. But a lot of these disputes are not, the subject matter is not something that is, you know, a new argument in the law or something that would develop the law. They're very minor.
Well, I think that one of the major arguments, though, in those types of circumstances, especially for consumers and employees, is not so much about development of the law as it is the cost, the ability to join a class action. A lot yes, of those right. principles really, I think, are more important. You know, it's not so much, oh, wow, we really need to develop law, because, you know, sometimes it's not about that. Sometimes it's really about giving a lower cost option than arbitration. Even if the business is fronting most of the costs, there's still an expense in terms of time and money versus, for example, joining a class action.
Right. So indeed. So in this case, there was no class action in the example
right.
I gave.
Okay. Yeah.
But absolutely, that's absolutely right. That. Most, but a lot of, I imagine. And I did code also for class action in the sense of, was there even a purported class action, you know, depending on.
Right, right. Did that have any impact? Was that more likely?
I think around 20% of the cases, you know, the word class action was in there somewhere, right? That they
right.
that's what the kind of they were claiming that they were going for. But we didn't test it as a variable as such, whether it impacted okay. anything or not. Again, the minority of cases was that raised. And it is true. And in, you know, in other articles, I argue that perhaps that is perhaps the one aspect of the Supreme Court's jurisprudence of the FAA in the United States that I would say we need to rethink. But that's because I believe that class arbitration is something that is entirely possible. So I disagree with that rationale that the FAA envisioned arbitration as being individual and bilateral necessarily.
Well, and as so, far as, yeah, and you also talk about things that weren't important. So I don't want to miss out on that piece as well, because I think that might be interesting to the listeners, you know, kind of, you know, sharing that, you know, it didn't matter state or federal. It also didn't matter in terms of Republican or Democrat, in terms of who appointed the judge or yeah. sort of the political leanings. You have kind of a laundry list of things that don't matter. So maybe you want to share that.
Yeah, it's interesting. So yeah. So it doesn't really matter, not in a statistically significant way, whether you go to state trial court or the federal district court. But again, the state trial courts were overwhelmingly out of California. But again, the logic dictates that other states would be even more inclined to compel than the California courts. So we're guessing that it would be similar, if not more, higher rate of compelling other state trial courts. Which indicates, I think, to parties, because I saw a lot, there's parties that are trying to compel arbitration and they are sued in state courts. They try to remove it. They always try to remove it to federal courts.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of, you know, resources, and it's a lot of, you know, the emotion and emotion practice and all that. And it's kind of forum shopping. And there's really, it turns out, not really apparently a very good reason to do that, because the state courts, it seems, are inclined to compel just as much as the state trial courts are inclined to compel. Then, yes, the political affiliation, which I think is good news, that no matter who appointed the judge, really, in most situations, very particular combinations of level and play and a level of court and a type of court, state or federal, in combination with Republican or Democratic, gave some statistically significant outcomes, but they're really kind of minor. And in the grand scheme of things, it does not seem to statistically significantly matter whether your judge is a democratically appointed or a Republican appointed. I think that's good news, because you want, right? You want everybody to apply the law the same and not politicize.
That's good.
So well, that's good news.
Yeah.
Rule of
yeah.
law. yeah. And so that was interesting. Yeah, those things were interesting. And so the arguments were the factor that was very strong. As I said, the type of dispute, so if it's consumer, employment, labor, business or international. So we had quite a few types of disputes that we looked at. They all basically, or I should say employment and consumer were counterintuitively, again, were the most common types of disputes that were, or I should say that's actually, I expected them to be the most contested, because it is the most contested. Arbitration in the consumer and employment context,
okay,
right?
Yeah.
Not so much in the business context where it's negotiated and there's, you know, there's no imbalance of power and all that. So we did see employment and consumer cases were the most common types of disputes underlying contested motions. But employment, and I thought then business disputes would be the most compelled, but no. Actually, employment disputes were the most compelled, and consumer and business were on par. And that was the counterintuitive part.
Yeah, that's
and
interesting.
One explanation for the employment disputes being compelled the most, unconscionability was raised the most in employment disputes. And it is a losing argument, as I said. And so if all you got to go on is unconscionability, you're likely to be compelled in the employment context. And consumer, I think it's because of those formation arguments that are raised the most in consumer, and that seemed to be causing courts to pause and deny. And in the business context, it's also, I was surprised that actually quite a few cases were denied arbitration in the business context, and also formation existence arguments were present there, not so much about the consent, a mutual consent element, but about non-signatories.
Yes.
And which is kind of a consent argument, but different than in the consumer context.
Right.
So so it really depends.
That's interesting. Well, and of course, me as a contracts professor, I understand that. And certainly when I look at contract law and sort of, you know, the formation questions and the third party questions, non-signatories, absolutely. I can see that makes it very much. And in terms of significant findings that changed from your first iteration to the most recent iteration, what are the most significant findings that changed?
I would say, so because we added a lot more cases, because I added Bloomberg after I presented at OSU. And so because we added a lot of cases, we got more consumer cases than we had before. And that really changed our results, which I thought was a good thing, because then it proves to us that, you know, perhaps now we have actually a substantial enough sample to draw conclusions. Before we did not. Also, from feedback that I got, I changed a bit the definition of what counts as a business dispute versus consumer versus employment. It's not always easy to draw these lines. It is a coding issue that we had to deal with. For instance, how do you treat executives that have employment contracts?
Right.
But they're sophisticated parties. They usually have counsel. Do you really code them as employment? That's not really what employment in this context represents. So is it more of a business dispute? And sometimes the line is blurry also in the consumer
Well,
context.
that's always been true also, for example, in small businesses. So when you're looking at small businesses or franchise agreements, that's a longstanding sort of disagreement. Do you put franchise in the same pot with all business, or is it really more like a consumer context because of balance of power?
Right. And so that's a very good example. And so so at some point when you do this, you got to make a decision as the coder. And as long as you disclose how you coded, right, that people can understand what it means, then you know, you got to make a decision. It's somebody's got to decide how to.
Yeah.
And so I use, because I read all of these cases, and then ultimately I kind of used what made sense in the context of how courts decide these cases, how they treat these kind of parties or subject matters, and what makes sense in terms of our research question, right?
Right.
And so so all of the coding, you know, is transparent and is in the article in terms of those decisions. But yeah, they weren't easy. So we added cases, and that changed the results. We added a lot of California cases. We added a lot more state cases because of those California cases, and that changed our conclusions quite a bit. But again, it's not comprehensive.
Right.
We don't claim to have seen every state case. It's just not possible. I'm sure a lot of them are bench decisions that are not even, anywhere. So there's real limitations that are just built into the system to get your hands for research purposes, especially on state decisions. And it's a challenge. But I think that the outcomes that we got are at least representative, we think, of how the real picture would look if we could get our hands on every single case.
Well,
I wish
really
I could.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting stuff. You know, I think it's always really important to look at what happens, you know, in the lower courts, not just the Supreme Court. I always remember back in practice, I did a lot of arbitration, and we never went to court even about arbitration. We just went to arbitration. And so I think in certain areas of the law, that's very common. And I remember Chris Strohosel, he's done quite a bit of empirical research on arbitration. He's also a mentor of mine. I really admire his work. And I remember he had shared a study, and I remember it was something like 90% or something like that of cases just go to arbitration without ever stopping at a court. And that was really interesting to me. And I may be misquoting the exact percentage, but then, you know, there's still that 10% or there's still that group, and sort of what inspires them, what arguments they're bringing. It's a real contribution to the scholarship. So thank you so much, Tamar. I really appreciate it, and really interesting stuff, you know, and I think it creates a baseline for further analysis, you know, for example, diving more deeply into particular states, because there's been other research to suggest that there's particular states that are less likely to enforce arbitration in state court. And is that true? Is it just sort of this myth? Is it real?
No, so I can tell you it's a myth in California.
It is, so it might be worth it to say, okay, well, what's that, you know, Montana, like there's been some, they, you know, let's look more deeply at this and see if it's really true. And then I love this work also, thank you so much, because, you know, from now sort of doing more comparative analysis would be very interesting as well, like what happens in lower courts in Canada, for example.
It's fascinating. We don't have time to get it, but the comparison between US and Canada is fascinating because we have such similar legal systems.
Exactly.
But arbitration, it's night and day. It's very different.
It's so interesting. Well, I am just delighted. Thank you. You're just so interesting, really good work. And thank you for sharing it with our listeners. And thank you for sharing it on the arbitration conversation. I've really appreciated this. And I know I'll be listening to it again. I can guarantee you I'll be asking my students to listen as well. And I really appreciate it very much. We all do.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
This podcast was brought to you by Arbitrate.com. For more information about Arbitrate.com's programs and content, please visit our website at www.arbitrate.com.